ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Lee Bowery was not a man you could overlook. Born in Sunshine, Melbourne, he left suburbia for Soho, London, remaking himself into someone impossible to contain. At the club Taboo, he was ringmaster of chaos. For artist Lucian Freud, he was muse. And for choreographer Michael Clark, a collaborator. But for the queer underground, Lee was revelation. Proof that life itself could be spectacle. And spectacle, survival. Tate Modern's recent exhibition, Lee Bowery! Brought his world back into focus. Hi, I'm Michael Doe, and this is The Art Show. Today I'm joined by curator Fenton Moran to talk about Lee's legacy, how a Melbourne boy became a myth, and why he continues to matter today. Fenton, welcome.
Hi there, nice to be here.
Now, Fenton, Lee Bowery, he was many things: performance artist, designer, club star, muse, provocateur. I mean, where do we even start?
I mean, it is quite overwhelming looking at his life, even though he died very young, because he did so many things. But he once said, you know, if you try to label me, you negate me. And that kind of set up an even bigger challenge, because he didn't want to be defined by any one identity or profession. But for me, I kind of always see him as a performance artist and who wanted to make his life almost like an artwork. And by doing that, you can bring in his work as a fashion designer, but also his work performing in clubs and in galleries and on stage. And then at the end of his life, when he started to work in the kind of music area and write music.
And Fenton, as a curator who makes sense of art history, who makes sense of artworks, how do you even begin to make sense of a man who refused or did not want to be negated in this way?
I mean, when I was reading a lot of the interviews that Lee did, one thing he said, which was really helpful, was the fact that it was punk that really made him want to come to London, and also made him realise that clothing and how you appear can communicate different ideas, and it doesn't have to just be, you know, purely functional. And I think that's what he was trying to do with his kind of elaborate kind of dressing ups and his performances, is that to push people into thinking about how we read identity, but also how we read all forms of imagery. And so that, for me, that was a really helpful starting point.
Yes.
And as well as, you know, him loving people like John Waters, who was known for kind of shock value as well.
Yes. And I want to start at his beginning, his origin story, specifically the journey from Sunshine, Melbourne to London, where he became Lee Bowery, to Lee Bowery!
Yeah, so he was born in Sunshine, and to Tom and Evelyn. And he had about 22 months after he was born, his sister arrived, Bronwyn. And he was apparently a very kind of precocious child, very inquisitive. And his sister spoke about how he loved being able to kind of charm all of his mother's friends and get more attention than his sister. So there was always this very strong desire to be at the center of things. And he apparently excelled at school. He was, you know, learned the piano, and his parents actually thought he might go to a conservatory to learn music. But he, you know, partly inspired by punk and hearing about the clubs in London and also pop stars, he decided to study fashion design at the Emily Macpherson College, which was then becoming part of the Melbourne Institute of Technology. But he was only there for 2 years, I believe. And I've seen conflicting reports. He either just decided to leave or he was asked to leave. But he found it a bit boring, or happened to learn the rudimentaries of kind of technical fashion design and designing underwear and children's clothes, and decided he wanted to go to London, which he felt was more of an exciting place for his aspirations. But his parents insisted he had to save up enough money for a return flight home. So he worked in a department store in Melbourne. You can kind of get a sense of his ambition from this, you know, young age, because he arrives in London at the age of 19. So he had a very strong drive.
It makes so much sense that you talk about him studying fashion, working in a department store, because Lee's medium really centered the body. We see him in sequins, latex, prosthetics, masks. There's a great sense of bodily distortion and excess. And so tell me about the relationship between studying fashion, which is really about beauty and presentation, to the kind of taboo-breaking looks that Lee offered.
Yeah, because it's good that you say that, because at the end of his, towards the end of his life, he did an interview where he said, if there's one dominant recurring interest, it is the body. And to him, the body was endless, like what you could do with it. And I think talking to some of his friends, they said his kind of interest in kind of pushing the limits of what could be considered beautiful or even considered something that you would want to wear in public, even though to other people it might look weird, was perhaps connected to him not feeling attractive growing up. And he was kind of always a bit on the heavier side, and his weight fluctuated a lot, and his hair began receding quite young. And so some people have interpreted his desire to become more than human almost as partly a response to that. But I think there was also this kind of dynamic, kind of provocative sensibility at the time, where, you know, a lot of him, Lee and his friends would go and see kind of shocking kind of horror films, or like the films of John Waters that I mentioned. And Divine, who was in a lot of those John Waters films, was a really big influence on him. And there's one film, Female Trouble, where Divine has these kind of boils and scabs on her face, but she thinks she looks beautiful. And I think that kind of idea of flipping things and turning things upside down was something that he continually tried to do, and kind of make you kind of question the kind of ideas around taste that are also connected to art as well, the idea of like aesthetics and what's beautiful. So I think his studying fashion kind of gave him this very acute, his ability to really focusing on detail and really think about, you know, how things are constructed and what that means.
And you mentioned a really interesting point, that Lee was not working in isolation, that he was a collaborator, a muse, and was so many things to so many different people. So I'd love to talk more about Michael Clark, that incredible choreographer that you mentioned, who, I mean, he spliced ballet with punk fashion irreverence, and as you mentioned, Lee did the costume. So how did Lee bring Michael's vision of dance to life, or challenge it to life?
Well, I think Michael was also a punk fan, and as many of that scene were, and they met in a club, and Michael approached Lee initially to, you know, make costumes for his work. But Lee would always just make costumes that were just whatever Lee was wearing at the time. He didn't try to modify his designs too much to what Michael wanted. And Michael actually liked that, because he said traditional costume designers are too accommodating. And so he liked the fact that Lee was challenging the choreography itself by making costumes that were sometimes quite difficult to move in, or quite awkward, or sometimes quite funny. And Michael's choreography has a lot of humor in it. And Lee was a really funny person. And I think that kind of just really pushed Michael's work into, you know, further and further. But they had essentially a very shared sensibility. And so it was a very strong collaboration that lasted for around 10 years.
And Lucian Freud, the great British painter of flesh, I mean, his portraits just reveal every line, vein, and wound. And so what drew each of them to one another?
Well, apparently, Lucy and Freud did go to Taboo because he's on one of the guest lists that we found. But he was properly introduced to Lee after Lee did a performance in a gallery in front of a two-way mirror. And the artist, the Welsh artist, Kenneth Wyn Evans, who was one of Lee's best friends, and his boyfriend, Angus, they thought it'd be funny to make Lucien paint loads of sequins, because Lucien was known for mostly painting people naked. But then, so they set up a meeting, and Lee apparently wore clothes that were the colour, the kind of muted colour palette of Lucien's paintings. And then when it was all agreed, he went to the studio, and Lee just assumed he would be naked, so he stripped. And that, you know, began the long-standing kind of period of him modelling for Lucien. But it was more than just a kind of a job. They became very close friends, and I think they both kind of had shared a kind of a desire to kind of not follow society's rules, and also sometimes be quite antagonistic, and also have a very strong sexual appetite, to be honest. And I think Lucien apparently really enjoyed Lee's shocking stories, or stories that he would sometimes embellish a lot. And equally, Lee really had a great thirst for knowledge and was always interested in people and ideas. And Lucien really brought that to him as well. So it was a very important kind of friendship. And also the fact of modelling for an artist and spending hours just kind of daydreaming potentially made Lee think more about how he was using his body in his work. And around this period, which is in the 90s, Lee starts to show a lot more of his flesh and his costumes and tape up his flesh in unusual ways. And so it kind of shows him pushing outside of the realms of traditional fashion or clothing design into something more sculptural.
Fenton, it's interesting because I was so struck by Lucien's paintings of Lee, because up until that point, as you say, we see Lee as this confident, sort of fully formed being who incorporates the latex prosthetics mass, this idea of distortion and excess. But in those portraits of him, Lucien's painted him sort of reposed, very calm. There's a soft tenderness of vulnerability there. And so to kind of show and allow that to be shown, that must have been an incredible relationship of trust and mutual respect there.
Yeah, I mean, I think Lee was, he did love being naked, apparently, and he would walk around his flat naked quite a lot. So I wouldn't say modelling for him made him, you know, it was difficult for him to pose naked, but he did talk about being forced to look at his body, you know, completely naked, helped him to come to terms with how, you know, his actual physical appearance and kind of a different kind of relationship to it. And I think the fact that he got on so well with Lucien also meant a lot, and perhaps that is also shown in some of the portraits. But I mean, even the one of the big ones that we had in the exhibition, which is Lee with his leg kind of propped up on a mattress, to me kind of suggests that while that he's kind of naked and potentially kind of more human, there is also this still a sense of performing a little bit. And actually, the act of modelling for anyone, there's always a little bit of a sense of, you're very much aware that you're being looked at. And so there's a level of kind of theatricality to that. But on the other hand, there's also some smaller portraits that Lucien did where there is that slightly more obvious, tender relationship to the human body, especially the ones where Lee is kind of resting or sleeping. And so I think it kind of created this, it offers a kind of different side of Lee, and also kind of, for me, made me think about Lucien Freud's paintings in relationship to ideas around performance and what the role of the model has in an artist's work, because they do bring a lot, especially, and Lee definitely brought a lot to those kind of canvases through the force of personality.
You're listening to The Art Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Michael Doe, and today I'm speaking with Fenton Moran on Lee Bowery's legacy. Now, Fenton, I'd like to talk about Taboo, the nightclub Lee ran in London in the mid-1980s. And as I walked through the exhibition, I saw the photos, the footage. I mean, the outfits, the delirium, the chaos. What a laboratory.
Yeah, I mean, I was really jealous looking at all the photos and watching the few videos that exist of the club. But the guest list I mentioned that had Lucien Freud on it, a lot of the other names show that, that it really was a laboratory of kind of great kind of designers, performers, artists, scenesters, because you have Michael Clark on there, a lot of the dancers, a lot of journalists who wrote for ID and The Face. And it was a kind of space that was essentially a group of friends putting on a night for each other. And then as it became more notorious, obviously more people came. But it was very much this kind of very dynamic kind of scene that only lasted for just over a year. So like most great clubs. And it did become kind of, it's the thing that made Lee properly famous, at least, you know, in the UK, and got him a lot of attention. And a lot of that was partly him, the presence that he had as a host, but also the fact that all the people that were going were also had a similar sensibility and enjoyed dressing up. And this was in 1985, and the new romantic era was kind of, in London at least, seen as over by around 1980, 81. So even people from that scene said Taboo kind of gave a kick up the behind in terms of like showing that there was still a kind of dynamic kind of dressing up club scene.
Well, let's go into the queer underground for a little bit. And it's an interesting space because Lee's sensibility was that life could be spectacle. Life was not 9 to 5. There's a sense of theatre to it, theatre as a way of living. So tell me about his impact at the time on queer identity and really shaping that moment.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's quite interesting thinking about Lee in relation to kind of the gay scene, because he wasn't necessarily very political with a capital P. He didn't kind of actively go to lots of gay pride marches or campaign in that kind of way. But in his, at least for me, in his defiant kind of approach to living his life on his own terms and not really caring what people thought and dressing up however he wanted to dress, there was a politics to it, I think, if you think about the fact that while homosexuality had been legalized in the UK, there were still a lot of rules around how that could be practiced. So if there was, it could only take place, sex between men could only take place in private. And if there was another person in the house, it was illegal. And it also, that kind of ruling meant there was a lot more arrests of men kind of checking each other out on the streets. So it was a very difficult time. There was still a lot of prejudice against the community, and that only increased with the AIDS epidemic and it being associated with kind of gay culture. And so I think Lee's and also his and people like Michael Clark, their kind of continual showcasing of a kind of alternative idea around sexuality and also gender really flew in the face of that. And then the fact that Lee, you know, would appear in kind of newspapers or magazines and then even on TV shows like The Clothes Show, which would be shown on BBC on a Sunday afternoon. The fact that, you know, he's appearing in these kind of other spaces would have been a kind of beacon of light for people growing up in the suburbs. And I met a few people who heard about Lee and the scene through those magazines or through seeing him on a TV show and what that meant to them in terms of suggesting that there's this other world to be discovered. And it's a world that Lee never left behind. You know, he was always going back to kind of queer clubs and performing or showing up in a new outfit. And it was kind of his ready-made gallery that he could always return to. And I think that kind of commitment to where he came from was really kind of, is a really important thing. And also thinking about clubs as, obviously they're places to have fun, but they're also places where people form a kind of community or form connections or be inspired. So they're a really important kind of aspect, and they obviously bring a lot of life to the culture of a city. So I wanted to, within the exhibition, kind of somehow show that kind of web of connections.
Mm. And you mentioned Lee died of AIDS during the crisis in 1994. He was only 33. And that's an incredibly young age to be robbed of your life and vitality and creativity, all things which he pursued with such great appetite. So when he got this news and realized that life was limited, how did that shape him? How did he react to that?
So he apparently went for the test in the late 80s, but he never went for the result, which wasn't uncommon because there's a lot of fear at the time. But he finds out at the end of 1988, and he dies in 1994, and he finds out by receiving a letter in the post asking how he's coping with being HIV positive. And it was a massive shock to him, even though he would cruise. He had apparently been cruising since he was 12 years old, he says, although he apparently would make up lots of lies. But so there was obviously a worry or that he could be HIV positive. But when he finds out, he only tells Sue Tilley, who was one of his closest friends and would go on to write a book about Lee. And apart from Sue, and then he tells his other friend, Nicola Rainbird, who is in charge of the Lee Bowery estate now, and she worked on a lot of them, making a lot of the costumes. He told her in an argument and then denied it afterwards. But she said she felt there was an understanding there that she kind of knew. But essentially, he dealt with it by not really telling anyone. And the reason was because he didn't want to be defined by the illness and didn't want people to think the things that he was doing were the result of that. And obviously that may have been tied up with elements of shame and other things. But I think his approach was really to kind of go into overdrive and to just work even harder and to ensure he made his mark on culture and lived his life to the fullest.
And Fenton, you began the interview by saying that Lee refused to be defined because that was negating him. But in your process of putting together the show, has there been something which has really emerged, a lesson learned, a thesis to be taken away, something that really kind of distills the essence of this man?
The phrase, "Would you let yourself in?" which was asked on the door of Taboo, we used that as the last line on the text that we have on the wall in the very last room of the exhibition, because in a way it kind of made me think about how what Lee was creating was a kind of a world that he was asking you to let yourself in, or to asking you to question all the things you might take for granted, or question how we read images or people, and actually asking yourself to kind of flip the narrative and maybe challenge yourself to enter into the unknown and things that are scary.
You've been listening to curator Fenton Moran reflecting on Lee Bowery, recently on show at Tate Modern in London. I'm Michael Doe, and this is The Art Show. You can listen back to this and all our episodes on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. The Art Show is produced by Sky Kirkham. Catch you next week. Up next, Arts in 30.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.